A bastard contraption. Mungo St. John watched her battle with all his attention, judging her performance at every point of the wind. We're toying with her. As long as there's breath of wind, we'll romp away from her. Astern, the gunboat's commander had abandoned his attempt to run the clipper down with steam power alone, and had come back onto a fine reach with all his canvas set, plugging along stubbornly in Huron's streaming wake. Until abruptly, with no warning at all, Huron sailed into a deep hole in the wind. The line of the gale was drawn clearly across the surface of the sea. On one side, the water was darkened and furrowed by the talons of the wind. On the other, the humpbacks of the rollers in the calm had a polished, velvety gloss to them. As Huron crossed that line of demarcation, the clamour of the wind, which for a week after week had battered their ears, fell to an eerie, unnatural silence, and the ship's motion changed from the vital charge of a living, straining sea creature to the patternless rolling and wallowing of a dead log. Overhead, her canvas volleyed and flapped in the directionless eddies created by her own rolling and pitching, and her tackle crashed and clattered so that it seemed she might roll her masts clean out of her hull. Far astern, the black-painted gunboat scrambled on eagerly, swiftly beginning to narrow the distance between them, the black column of coal smoke now rising straight up into the stillness of air, giving her a jubilant and menacing air. Mungo St. John ran to the forward rail of the quarterdeck and stared over his bows. He could see the wind 2 or 3 miles ahead, clawing at the sea and ruffling it to a sombre shade of indigo. But between them was the oily, undulating surface of the calm. He swung back, and the gunboat was closer, sending her smoke spurting high against the bright, windswept blue of the sky, so certain of herself now that her gun ports were swinging open and the stubby barrels of her 32-pounder cannon protruding from the black sides of her hull, the churning wash of her screw tumbling out from under her counter and sparkling whitely in the sunlight. With no way upon Huron, the helmsman could not hold any course, and the clipper drifted around broadside to the onrushing man-of-war, putting her bows directly into the rollers. They could make out the individual figures of the 3 officers on the gunboat's bridge now. Again the bow chaser fired, and the shell lifted a tall column of water so high and close under the Huron's bows that it collapsed upon the deck and streamed out through the scuppers. Mungo St. John took one last despairing sweep of the horizon, hoping even now for a resurgence of the wind, and then he capitulated. "Hoist the colours, Mr. Tipu," he called. And as the gaudy scrap of cloth drooped from the mainyard in the windless air, he watched through the lens of his telescope the consternation it caused upon the gunboat's bridge. That was the last flag they had hoped to see. They were now close enough to discern the individual expressions of chagrin and alarm and indecision of the naval officers.
"There'll be no prize money for you. Not this time round," Mungo St. John murmured with grim satisfaction, and snapped the telescope shut.
The gunboat came on, and then rounded up to Huron, within easy hail, showing her full broadside, the long 32-pounder cannon gaping menacingly. The tallest officer on her bridge seemed also the oldest, for his hair was white in the sunlight. He came to the gunboat's near rail, and lifted the voice trumpet to his mouth.
"What ship?"
"Huron out of Baltimore and Bristol," Mungo St. John hailed back, "with a cargo of trade goods for Cape of Good Hope and Mozambique."
"Why did you not answer my challenge, sir?"
"Because, sir, I do not acknowledge your right to challenge ships of the United States of America on the high seas." Both captains knew just what a thorny and controversial question that reply posed, but the Englishman hesitated only a second. "Do you, sir, accede to my right to satisfy myself as to your nationality and your ship's port of registry?" "As soon as you run in your guns, you may come aboard for that purpose, Captain. But do not send one of your junior officers." Mungo St. John was making a fine point of humiliating the commander of the Black Joke. But inwardly, he was still seething at the fluke of wind and weather which had allowed the gunboat to come up with him. The Black Joke launched a longboat on the heavy swell with an immaculate show of seamanship, and had pulled swiftly to Huron's side. While the captain scrambled up the rope ladder, the boat's crew backed off and rested on their oars. The naval officer came in through the entry port, so lithe and agile that Mungo St. John realized his error in thinking him an elderly man. It was the white blonde hair that had misled him. He was evidently less than 30 years of age. He did not wear a uniform coat, for his ship had been cleared for action, and he was dressed in a plain white linen shirt, breeches and soft boots. There were a pair of pistols in his belt and a naval cutlass in its scabbard on his hip. "Captain Codrington of Her Majesty's auxiliary cruiser Black Joke," he introduced himself stiffly. His hair was bleached in silver-white splashes from the salt and the sun, with darker streaks beneath, and it was tied with a leather thong in a short queue at the nape of his neck. His face was weathered to honey golden brown by the same sun, so that the faded blue of his eyes was in pale contrast. "Captain St. John, owner and master of this vessel." Neither man made move to shake hands, and they seemed to bristle like two dog wolves meeting for the first time. "I hope you do not intend to detain me longer than is necessary. You can assure yourself that the American government will be fully apprised of this incident." "May I inspect your papers, Captain?" The young naval officer ignored the threat and followed St. John onto the quarterdeck. There he hesitated for the first time when he caught sight of Robin and her brother standing together at the far rail. But he recovered immediately, bowed slightly, and then turned his full attention to the packet of documents that Mungo St. John had ready for his inspection on the chart table. He stood over the table, working swiftly through the pile, until with a shock of discovery he straightened. "Damn me! Mungo St. John! Your reputation precedes you, sir." The Englishman's expression was strained with strong emotion. "And what a noble one it is, too!" There was a bitter sting in his voice. "The first trader ever to carry more than 3,000 souls across the Middle Passage in a single 12-month period. Small wonder you can afford such a magnificent vessel." "You are on dangerous ground, sir," Mungo St. John warned him with that lazy, taunting grin. "I am fully aware of the lengths to which the officers of your service will go for a few guineas of prize money. Where are you going to pick up your next cargo of human misery, Captain St. John?" the Englishman cut in brusquely. "On such a fine ship, you should be able to pack in 2,000. He had gone pale with unfeigned anger, actually trembling slightly with the force of it. "If you have finished your investigation," St. John's smile did not slip, but the naval officer went on speaking. "We have made the West Coast a little too hot for you now, have we? Even when you hide behind that pretty piece of silk." The naval officer glanced up at the flag on the mainyard. "So you are going to work the East Coast now, are you, sir? They tell me you can get a prime slave for $2. Two for a 10-shilling musket. I must ask you to leave now." St. John took the document from his hand, and when their fingers touched, the Englishman wiped his hand on his own thigh as though to cleanse it of the contact. "I'd give 5 years' pay to have the hatches off your holds," he said bitterly, leaning forward to stare at Mungo St. John with those pale, fierce eyes. "Captain Codrington." Zuga Ballantyne stepped towards the group. "I am a British subject and an officer of Her Majesty's Army. I can assure you there are no slaves aboard this vessel." He spoke sharply. "If you are an Englishman, then you should be ashamed to travel in such company." Codrington glanced beyond Zuga. "And that applies equally to you, madam." "You overreach yourself, sir," Zuga told him grimly. "I have already given you my assurance." Codrington's gaze had flicked back to Robin Ballantyne's face. Her distress was evident, unfeigned. The accusation had shattered her, that she, the daughter of Fuller Ballantyne, the great champion of freedom and sworn adversary of slavery, she, the accredited agent of the Society for the Extinction of the Slave Trade, should be travelling aboard a notorious slaver. She was pale, the green eyes huge and liquid with the shock of it. "Captain Codrington," Her voice was husky and low. My brother is right. I also assure you that there are no slaves aboard this ship. The Englishman's expression softened. She was not a beautiful woman, but there was a freshness and wholesomeness about her which was difficult to resist. I will accept your word, madam. He inclined his head. Indeed, only a madman would carry black ivory towards Africa. But, and his voice hardened again, if only I were able to enter her holds, I'd find enough down there to run her into Table Bay under a prize crew and have her condemned out of hand at the next session of the Court of Mixed Commission. Codrington swung on his heel to face Mungo St. John again. Oh, yes, I know that your slave decks will be struck to make way for your trade cargo, but the spare planks are aboard, and it won't take you a day to set them up again, Codrington almost snarled. And I'll wager there are open gratings under those hatch covers. He pointed down at the main deck, but without taking his eyes from Mungo St. John's face. And that there are shackles in the lower decks to take the chains and leg irons. Captain Codrington, I find your company wearying, Mungo St. John drawled softly. You have 60 seconds to leave the ship before I have my mate assist you over the side. Tipu stepped forward, hairless as an enormous toad, and stood a foot behind Codrington's left shoulder. With a visible effort, the English captain retained his temper as he inclined his head towards Mungo St. John. May God grant we meet again, sir. He turned back to Robin and saluted her briefly. May I wish you a pleasant continuation of your voyage, madam. Captain Codrington, I think you are mistaken, she almost pleaded with him. He did not reply, but stared at her for a moment longer. The pale eyes were direct and disturbing, the eyes of a prophet or a fanatic. Then he turned and went with a gangling, boyish stride to Huron's entry port. Tipu had stripped off the high-necked tunic and oiled his upper body so it gleamed in the sunlight with the metallic luster of the skin of some exotic reptile. He stood stolidly on flat bare feet, balancing effortlessly to the Huron's roll, his thick arms hanging at his side and the lash of the whip coiled on the deck at his feet. There was a grating fixed at the ship's side, and the sailor who had been at the masthead lookout when they had raised the African coast was spread-eagled upon it like a stranded starfish on a rock exposed at low tide. He twisted his head awkwardly to look back over his shoulder at the mate, and his face was white with terror. "You are excused witnessing punishment, Dr. Ballantyne," Mungo St. John told her quietly. "I feel it my duty to suffer this barbaric..." "As you wish." He cut her short with a nod and turned away. 20, Mr. Tipu. 20 it is, Captain. With no expression at all, Tipu stepped up behind the man, hooked his finger into the back of his collar, and ripped the shirt down to the belt. The man's back was pale as suet pudding, but studded with fat purple carbuncles, the sailor's affliction, caused by salty wet clothing and the unhealthy diet. Tipu stepped back and flicked out the lash, so that it extended to its full length along the seamed oak planking. "Ship's company," Mungo St. John called. "The charge is inattention to duty and endangering the ship's safety." They shuffled their bare feet, but not one of them looked up at him. "The sentence is 20 lashes. On the grating, the man turned his face away and closed his eyes tightly, hunching his shoulders. "Lay on, Mr. Tipu," Mungo St. John said. And Tipu squinted carefully at the bare white skin, through which the knuckles of the spine showed clearly. He reared back, one thickly muscled arm thrown high above his head, and the lash snaked higher, hissing like an angry cobra. Then he stepped forward into the stroke, pivoting the full weight and force of his shoulders into it. The man on the grating shrieked, and his body convulsed in a spasm that smeared the skin from his wrists against the coarse hemp bonds.